You know, I'm never quite sure when in the middle of the Where We Live love theme one starts talking, but I'm going to start talking right now. This is Colin McEnroe, John Dankosky off this week. It's still the Wheelhouse, though. We're very excited to do the Wheelhouse today. Obviously, last night, President Obama gave a State of the Union address, striking a more conciliatory, less partisan tone, a tone that sort of indicated his willingness to work with anyone. He said, "I have sung in hobo jungles, and I have sung for the Rockefellers, and I am proud that I have never refused to sing for anybody." Oh, wait a minute. That was Pete Seeger, wasn't it? He didn't say that last night. All right. Well, we're going to talk about both things today, as it turns out. We'll talk about the State of the Union address. We'll talk about Pete Seeger. And in the middle of all that, we'll talk about state politics, because the State of the Union address has a way of bleeding into state politics in a year like this one, in a midterm election year. So to do all that today, political analyst Bill Curry, who has worked on State of the Union addresses, is here with us, making her debut, introducing, as they say in the movies, Jennifer Swift, state politics reporter for Connecticut Magazine and the New Haven Register, and returning to us, Galila Brown Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. And obviously, if you want to chime in, you may call us at 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. So, we are going to start with you, Bill Curry, because, you know, one of the questions I had last night in a speech like this, he's got a lot of presidency still ahead of him. On the other hand, he's a second-term president. I sort of wondered who you thought he was speaking to last night. It struck me that there were a few times during the speech where I thought, wow, is he already talking to historians? He might be talking to historians already. And obviously also not wanting to say anything that could be fodder in a tough swing state race in this coming election, doesn't want to give the Republicans anything to work with, to put up on their bulletin board in the locker room. But you know, in terms of his agenda, in terms of President Obama's voice and whom he wanted to reach, who do you think he was talking to mostly last night?
First of all, in every big speech that a politician gives, a convention acceptance speech, a campaign kickoff, an inaugural, a State of the Union, they're almost always speaking to history, and too much, I've always thought, that you start – when you're swinging for those fences, you tend to miss the people in the park and you know, you forget to speak to the people who are alive right now. I didn't think he did too much of that last night. I thought that his first agenda was to speak to the broader public. It wasn't so much a rally your troops speech aimed at Democrats. It wasn't I guess for Obama, it was supposed to be this lay down the marker speech. There was a lot of advance hype about how he's going to really say, I'm doing it my way and doing the best I can and see you later. And I thought, well, this is Obama laying down the marker, you know, complimenting the opposition. There was very, very little in it that was confrontive when you really looked at it. I thought of – lastly, I'll just say that I thought of two things. First, that he was – the second thing you heard about the speech was he was going to go out with a lot of specific proposals, and there weren't any. People said of the Republican response that it wasn't specific. Neither speech was specific. He was hearkening back to something that I actually worked on with Clinton. Maybe we'll talk about it later. But the idea that you do that it's better to propose to actually do a lot of small concrete things than propose a lot of big abstract things. And supposedly they had taken that lesson, the Obama crowd, from the 95 Clinton speech. But I didn't see it in that speech. The second thought is just this, that I was surprised at how alike all the speeches were, especially the president's and the and the Republican – official Republican response. And it's one of the ironies that as our parties drift farther apart, they use the same technology of focus groups and polls to determine their message. And increasingly, I first noticed this in the Al Gore-George Bush debate of 2000, in which you couldn't tell which one guy was for public education. You couldn't tell which guy was for the environment. They had drastically different positions, but they had all the same phrases. And if you look at the Republican response and the president's speech, they have opportunity proportionally about the same number of times. The president's speech was suffused with pretty general promises of creating opportunity in society, and the Republican response was, "Well, what about opportunity?" and they just and her language tracked his for the short time that she spoke to anything at all. The same group of people could have written either speech. As far apart as they are, the phrasing, the language, the atmospherics, almost identical.
Okay, I'm going to ask Kolei a little follow-up question about that. But just for people who didn't get him to hear him say the word opportunity at all last night because you were watching something else, just hear a little clip here. He's talking about income inequality.
What I believe unites the people of this nation, regardless of race or region or party, young or old, rich or poor, is the simple, profound belief in opportunity for all.
You know, Kalila, I agree with Bill that it was not a partisan or confrontational speech, although there was an underlying message. And even though he doesn't sing like Pete Seeger, one song that he was singing, I think, was With or Without You by U2.
Right.
And he was sort of – it was a smiling speech. It was, yeah, the guy behind me, his father was a barkeep. That's – you know, and even inviting Marco Rubio in for a certain amount of collusion on one initiative. But the underlying message was, I can't get anything through you guys, so, you know, I'm just going to do some stuff that you're not going to be involved in.
Right. So, you know, think about if I had a hammer, right? So I think the message last night was, this country needs to move forward. Americans are tired of government. They're tired of politicians. And that's not beholden to any one political party. So that when you have a president saying, I'm issuing these executive orders because Congress refuses to work with me. And then in Rand Paul's speech where he says, I'll work with you, but come to me. Come to me and talk to us and ask us. And so I think the average American wants to know, what does that really mean? What are we sending people to Washington to do? And are they going to do anything, whether it's big or small? Why are we so far into a congressional term, where we haven't seen anything substantive?
You know, it's interesting. I want to come back to the Rand Paul speech. Well, we should say it right now. It's an interesting dynamic, which is that, you know, traditionally there is an official Republican response. It was delivered last night by Kathy McMorris Rodgers from Washington, who gave kind of a rambling discursive speech that didn't really sort of engage with very much. I find myself remembering the last year's Saturday Night Live character, the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. But everybody, the speech everybody talks about is not the sanctioned speech. It's the
exactly.
one that you talk to.
It's the Rand Paul.
Yeah. It's like he's sort of hijacked that whole job, at least temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Intentionally, on behalf of himself.
Right. So Jennifer Swift, what did you hear last night? You're about to cover a contentious political race here in Connecticut, a series of contentious political races here in Connecticut. In the second segment, we'll talk even more about those. But as you listened last night, did you hear things that you either thought could help, say, a candidate like Elizabeth Esty running in a tight swing district? Are there things that would resonate, or are there things that she's going to have to struggle to defend?
Well, I definitely think, you know, you can see that there are a lot of things that the legislators in Connecticut did latch onto. They were, you know, they all send out statements after he gives his big speech. And a lot of them were just echoing his sentiment that while Connecticut itself has been making progress, it's not enough. And we still need to embrace a lot of different opportunities. And there's still a lot that we need to do when it comes to jobs, when it comes to healthcare, the economy. And so I think, you know, if you want to specifically, I think Elizabeth Esty, you know, when he was talking about healthcare, she's definitely been on the fence. She's definitely has supported healthcare, but she's also voted with the Republicans on a couple different things. And I think, you know, things like that and him talking about manufacturing and things like that, we're definitely going to need to see if they can pull off of what he was talking about in his speech and bring it a little bit more specifically back to Connecticut. What are they going to do in Connecticut to bring what he was just talking about as opportunities into actual legislation here?
You know, Bill, I was sort of watching this speech at one point and imagining what it would be like to watch this speech if you were from a different planet or something and just had never seen President Obama before, didn't really know too much about the current political climate. It seems to me that one of the things you would conclude that this was that this president was he identified in a very strong way with the military. You know, it wasn't just the Corey Remsburg moment. It was piece after piece after piece of the speech referred back to the military, getting troops out of certain situations, about contractors who serve the military. I mean, it just on and on, and getting a lot of applause lines there. And it did seem kind of, I mean, you know, I don't think he did mention Pete Seeger at all. And you know, in terms of who he identifies himself as now, maybe a real different guy than the guy who was being defined during the 2008 campaign as some kind of, you know, Bill Ayers palling around, peacenik, you know, hippie freak.
It never had anything to do with who he was. And this is when you stop and really look at the record, not only of his administration but of his life, from his first recorded political thoughts, this is a living avatar of the conventional wisdom. an absolute stand-in for the political and economic establishment of his time. And the it seems otherwise because the Tea Party and the right have been off on this little trip into a fantasy world, which and a very compelling fantasy world for millions of Americans, but it's a fantasy world. And it also has made I think it's tempted him. I think he was seduced into defending the establishment even more because he became sort of Horatio at the bridge, defending civilization itself against these marauders. And in truth, it's the establishment that's broken. And I much more of the things that worry me about America come from the supposed bipartisan center than they do from the Tea Party, which hasn't quite hurt me yet. precisely because of its own sort of self-destructive nature, and so you are going to again it's with a war as Gary Trudeau points out more than any other American, we're still fighting a war, and honoring the troops who were there is a worthy goal of a president, but it extends to so many things. You can't talk about any income inequality and not mention anything broken in the system itself. Mm-hmm. You can't say, as he does so often, I'm a market kind of guy and be advancing a middle-class cause because the market's not working for the middle class, because it's not being properly regulated, because there is no healthcare market. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can compare this to, the Mike Lee speech for the Tea Party was, again, the only real speech that spoke to crony capitalism, to the problems at the top. The Tea Party has stolen not just cultural but economic populism from the Democratic Party. Rand Paul, their solutions are phony and ineffectual and take you nowhere. But – and you know, maybe it's just my wonkish side. But I thought that there would if I would have hoped last night the president could have done a little bit of what the Tea Party and Paul did, which is try to really frame this issue. And when you say about speaking – when you asked before about speaking to history, if he were really speaking to history right now, there would have been a little more about global warming, a little more specificity about what's gone wrong with the market. There would have been some questioning of technology. You can't just keep saying we're more productive, so our wages would go up. We're more productive as an algorithm, precisely because we're laying mm-hmm. people off, which drives wages mm-hmm. down. And you know, this is not whether it's the technology or the global economy or global warming. There are a set of fundamental systemic changes that have to take place right now. And I just think that Obama isn't someone who sees that. He looks out and he sees a country with problems, but with no fundamental flaws. And he's more of a steward than a reformer, which is a good thing in many ways. But he's not going to – you know, the radicals out there happen to be all speaking on the right. And so the people who are most speaking about what's really broken aren't coming from the top really of either party, but certainly not of my own.
What were you going to say?
Well, two things. I don't even know what it means to be radical in politics anymore because it is often so difficult to tell – the difference in the positions. You know, everyone says we should support the troops. I don't understand why that's partisan. I don't understand why a member of Congress would not stand up and applaud that. But the tougher question is, what does it mean to support the troops? So that you can have members of the military there in attendance at that speech. But unless we're talking about providing comprehensive mental health support to people who come back, if we're not talking about increasing job opportunities and how that affects families, how that affects income inequality. You know, one of the things that I think really was overlooked last night in terms of all the discussion of the speech, the blue ribbons that members of Congress chose to wear. And the fact that you now have these unemployment benefits that have been cut, that's going to have an impact on every sector of our society. So whether it's a working class family, whether it's a middle class family, you know, people who have more disposable income, I wanted to hear more specific ideas last night, really from everyone, from the president and also from, you know, the four responders last night about how we're going to address that. How are we going to address the fact that young people are paying more to go to college with no real guarantee that there'll be a job on the back end or what that space will look like? I think Americans are fed up.
I sort of had the same reaction that, you know, this speech, although it masqueraded as a speech about sort of what's possible, you know, what can I actually do? Given the fact that the Congress is uncooperative, what can I actually do and how am I going to do it? So that was sort of, you know, one of the kind of conceptual frames of the speech. But then he didn't really talk that much about what he could do. Right. And he brought up a lot of things that were very, very compelling. Equal pay for women got a long, sustained applause line. But I don't think he said much more than equal pay for
but
women.
But how do we get there? Right?
There was a great deal. But in 1995, Bill Clinton's famous The Era of Big Government speech is over began a process that I actually was involved in. And I'd begun working for him a few months before and worked on that speech from Farmington. I was actually right about the time he gave the speech that I moved to Washington. And he began, again, that question of concreteness and specificity. And in response to what you just said before, I don't think every president is a centrist. And you don't get radical presidents.
Of course.
But maybe the new radicalism is specificity itself. And the simple idea that whether the idea is large or small, whether the proposal is large or small, you're going to tell them what it really is rather than give them just a representative phrase. And when Clinton, people may remember, got terrible reviews from the press for his speeches because they were long as Obama's was last night. And they were filled with all these people thought small ball kinds of issues. But it did partly – I know this is somewhat self-aggrandizing, but it came partly out of an early speech I had both with him and with Morris. And Clinton at that point was being criticized for being the legislator-in-chief and the philosopher-in-chief and for just talking too much. And I said, you know, my little job as comptroller before I'd run for governor in 94, that I learned that when I went to the legislature, no one really wanted to hear from me. That they all had lives of their own and all thought they'd be better comptroller than I was anyway. And I learned just to stick to my own branch of government and that the small things I could do for the public in my job were really what mattered and that Clinton should never go out and give another speech that didn't contain a specific concrete action. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just that you do small things by executive order, that you do specific concrete things that people can understand. And the reason the public responded so positively to these speeches, it wasn't that they were eloquent. I wish – having worked on them, I wish – I could say they were. Nobody has the collected speeches of Bill Clinton by their bedside. Clinton's speeches were wonderful, one, because he could turn an entire country into a living room in minutes by force of his own personality. But two, because the proposals in them – he didn't use a lot of words. He wasn't a verbose person at all actually. He just had 40 things he wanted to tell you. And when he disciplined himself to make sure they were specific actions, he began to click with the American people. I really do think between that simple change and the Republican shutdown that followed that winter, his fortunes were transformed. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that. I thought last night that I was going to see some of that. But they really can't liberate themselves from the politics of phrases. And so I think it would have been a stronger speech. Mm-hmm. What he did do well – and to go back to one last thing earlier about both speeches being the same, having the same phrases, and because they come from the same polls and the same focus mm-hmm. groups. What the polls and focus groups told every candidate, every leader speaking last night was the public hates all you guys so much that if you can just go out and be pleasant – that they just don't want – the one thing they don't want to hear is any more of this acrimonious baloney. And I think Obama's great strength last night, he is likable and he is charismatic. And the fact that he simply took the podium with all that ritualistic trapping behind mm-hmm. him and with self-confidence and fluidity and conversational ease, that thing alone reestablished himself as a person. It was of substantial political utility to him in the short run, next couple of weeks, you know, to try to get some traction on some ideas.
We got to take a break here in just a second. But before we do that, one last year I'd like to explore, and I'm guessing – I could be wrong. I'm guessing, Jennifer, you're the youngest person in the room. And one of the things I'm sort of wondering about is – I was wondering it last night is, you know, to what degree does this particular tradition of giving a one-hour speech make sense there's no real rule that says you have to do it. In fact, Woodrow Wilson, I think, was the first president ever to give the speech to Congress. Harry Truman was the first person to give it on television. LBJ was the first person to do it in primetime. But, you know, this whole idea of a one-hour primetime speech by the president in an era of Vines and Snapchat and relatively diminished attention spans, I'm just sort of wondering. I mean, you know, 20 years from now, well, you'll still be here. You know, Bill and I may be on a different journey by then. Are people – will there still
east
be –
east of the river? Are you thinking?
Are presidents still going to do this?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to have to look at whether or not it should be done the same way that it's been done, that it should still be an hour every single time. But I do think that people are still paying attention to it. The people that want to be interested in what's going on in their country, I think they're still going to sit down in front of it and watch it and see what's going on. And I think now, you know, we're still watching the State of the Union, but we're just talking about it differently. We're going to talk about it on Twitter and we're going to talk about it on social media and keep the conversation going and analyze it as it's going. So I think that could, you know, keep it alive and keep the conversation going with it.
One of the first things that popped up on Twitter was a Vine response by John Boehner, which I thought that's going to be a sign of the future right there for people who are unattuned to that. A Vine is a very, very short video that resets over and over again. I mean, just a few seconds long. So Bill said that the focus groups, the message to both sides was go out and be pleasant. One congressman who did not get that message, I think, was Congressman Grimm. He represents Staten Island. He had a little encounter with a reporter from New York One. Let's just hear that.
And just finally, before we let you go, since we have you here, we haven't had a chance to kind of talk about some
I'm
of the—
I'm not speaking about anything that's off topic. This is only about the president.
Well, what about—
Thank you.
All right. So Congressman Michael Grimm does not want to talk about some of the allegations concerning his campaign finances. We wanted to get him on camera on that, but he, as you saw, refused to talk about that. Back to you.
Why? Let me be clear to you. You have to do that to me again. I'm telling you.
If you didn't hear, he said, if you ever do that again, I will throw you off the balcony. So didn't get the message about being pleasant. All right. So
yeah, some guys are just permanently out of the loop, you know?
Could be.
Sounds like he has a lot in his mind also.
All right. Never threaten to throw somebody off a balcony while the camera is running. Yeah. It's a very bad idea. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about how this plays out in the state. All right, we're back. This is Where We Live. Specifically, this is The Wheelhouse. John Dankosky is not here. I'm Colin McEnroe, guest hosting, and with me, Bill Curry, a political analyst, Kalila Brown Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and introducing Jennifer Swift, state politics reporter for Connecticut Magazine and the New Haven Register. We should just talk a little bit about how last night does bleed into the coming race. And Jennifer's already talked about it a little bit, that probably the person who inherits the State of the Union address and President Obama's ideas and record, most poignantly, is Elizabeth Esty, running in the 5th District. Very tough district to run in. It's a swing district. It's tight. It can go either way. Obviously, as an incumbent, she ordinarily has an advantage. But she's out there on the trail right now having to basically either separate herself from President Obama's record or identify with her, usually kind of thread the needle one way or another. And, Tucker, do we have that tape? Do we have the tape of her and the guys harassing her? Does that exist? All right. So so here we go. This is Elizabeth Esty. She's making a campaign appearance. There's some Tea Party guys there who are bugging her and asking her the same question over and over again, which is, did President Obama lie about Obamacare or not? And let's hear how that went.
Would you like an answer?
Yes, I would. I'd like a yes or no answer.
Well, you know what, sir? The world is not a yes or no world.
Oh, it's not?
No.
You can't give me a yes or no answer to that?
My job is to serve you. And if you want to hire somebody who's going to decide whether they vote for or against the president on every single vote, that's not me. That's not what I ran on.
The World Is Not a Yes or No World was the original working title of the James Bond movie Die Another Day.
Yeah.
They decided it was just too long a title, actually.
Yeah. But Dr. Yes or No, I think, actually was Dr. the first yes film. Yeah. And they just thought it's too much.
But Jennifer, you kind of alluded to this before. She's got a little bit of a problem on her hands, right? This is a tightly knit district, and it really can tip either way. There are certain things she doesn't even know who her – first of all, she does not know for sure who her opponent is yet, and that may change things. And say a little bit about how you see this race.
Well, it seems like right now the likely candidate is going to be Mark Greenberg. It seems like he hasn't really stopped running against her since last time. And he's definitely been hammering down on Obamacare. And on her vote, and he's, you know, going with the opinion that this is not what people in the 5th District deserve, that they should – he wants to actually work to repeal Obamacare, that it should not be there. And Esty's kind of faced with supporting it, and she definitely comes out in statements and says that she 100% supports it, but she's also voted for amendments on it in the House, you know, saying that she thinks that there need to be certain things changed that will definitely help the people in her district. So you can see that – she supports it, but she also knows that she's going to have an election, you know, next year where people might want to go with a candidate who isn't in favor of it.
You know, Kalila, this is the kind of race that people watch because it is a swing district. Although I think the other thing that people kind of accept now is that because of redistricting, the House is going to be a Republican House for many years to come. I mean, nothing's going to change in this election cycle or probably the next one, right?
So I think people accept that it will continue to be a Republican-controlled House. The real question for 2014, since every seat in the House will be up for election, is what type of Republican House will it be? Will you have more moderate Republicans who may be willing to work with the president? Will the Tea Party reemerge and take some key seats? And overall, what do these candidates want to do? Are they only thinking about, let me get reelected, or are they thinking about future political plans? And I think that for someone like Elizabeth Esty, you really have to think about that. Can you win your seat and guarantee the 5th District, but will you isolate yourself from the party and then really minimize what you can do beyond this election?
Billy, you know this district pretty well. What should her message be?
Well, let me just say that I think, first of all, her message should be begin with a thank you note to Governor Malloy for appointing Andrew Rohrabach to the bench, who, if he were if he'd been doing what Greenberg had been doing, this would be on everybody's list of the top races in the country. I'm not sure it will be, because you can't beat somebody with I'm not saying Greenberg's nobody, but I will say that it just compare him to the message from all the Republicans last night. But especially from from the Republican congresswoman who spoke, Obamacare barely existed. And they know that people don't like Obamacare, but they don't want to repeal it. If you're in the Tea Party speech, you want to repeal it. If you're in the Republican speech, you don't want to repeal it. And so just making this a referendum on a repeal of Obamacare isn't such a smart thing for a Republican running Connecticut. The last thing is that Connecticut is much more apt to elect Republicans to state office, because because Connecticut Republicans haven't gone quite as far as the national Republicans have. One of the problems any Republican, even in a swing district, has to contend with is the fact that the national Republican Party is an object of some contempt for most swing voters in Connecticut. This is why so many Fairfield County, Litchfield County towns migrated to Democratic first selectmen over the last 20 years. There's been a long cultural march away from the National Republican Party. And to be running on the more conservative elements even of the National Republican Party in a Connecticut race is not a recipe for success.
I mean, I do think that one of the – I mean, you can't go by the applause in the room, but I thought one of President Obama's better moments last night and his more real moments last night was when he said, all right, stop trying to appeal Obamacare. All right, you did it 40 times.
Move on.
Now.
Yeah. Enough is enough.
And there was a big applause in the room, but you also get the feeling that America was applauding too. No matter what you think about this, unless you really hate Obamacare, this kind of exercise, it's a placeholder for a whole bunch of very obstructionist and unproductive behaviors in Congress. And so you don't want to get identified with that anyway. I mean, if you're offering to go up there and vote for the 41st time to repeal Obamacare, you're probably not going to impress anybody.
I mean, there are as with the governor's race, I mean, there are issues on which a Republican candidate could mount a very effective race and turn it into one of the great barn burners of all time. But the question is whether or not there's anyone on the horizon, or whether the likely nominee in each case will be the person who can embody and transmit that message. Mm-hmm. That's not at all clear.
And Jennifer, I haven't really seen. I mean, you may be following this more closely than I am. Obviously, there was a little bit of stirrings about the idea that maybe Dr. William Pettit would run in that district. I kind of don't think that's actually going to happen. There have been other people who've run in the past, as Bill pointed out. The candidate last time was Andrew Rohrabach, much more of a centrist than Mark Greenberg. There are other people who've run in the past: Justin Birney, Mike Clark, Sam Calagiuri. I don't hear about any of those people running. I mean, it seems like it's Greenberg's just by default, because nobody else is snapping at it so far anyway.
Right. It definitely seems like he's the big name out in front. There is another individual who's thrown his hat in, Sal Lilienthal, who says he also wants it. But Greenberg has been going out and trying to get the endorsement from every single RTC, from every state rep. He's trying to get, you know, everything he can. Every day he gets another endorsement. So he's definitely coming out as the name, you know, that Elizabeth Esty is going to have to worry about.
Another big political development. It's not a big political development. What am I saying? Yesterday, Mark Boughton, who's the mayor of Danbury, announced his running mate, a former Groton mayor and current town councilor, Heather Summers, whom I personally have never heard of, but that's really good preparation for being lieutenant governor because no one's ever going to hear about you again anyway. About and address this the timing. This is a little unusual. In January, you don't have the nomination. You're already announcing who your running mate is. Anyway, he announced it yesterday in this way. Or do we not have tape of that, or am I just going to read that? No, I think we have tape of that. Let's hear Mark Boughton. Or maybe we don't. Maybe not. All right. Well, then I actually have the transcript here. It just made sense that we got started early. I mean, we're psyched and we're pumped up and we are ready to go. And we just thought, why bother waiting? The times are so challenging and the issues are so important that we should be working together right now as a team to share our vision of Connecticut. So it's definitely a different approach. And we think it's a winning approach. And it's why we're so excited today. He actually, I think I saw him quoted somewhere else saying that he might announce other parts of his under ticket, right? He may not be done. He may be announcing his attorney general candidate or something, Jennifer.
Yeah, he said that that's definitely a possibility. We could expect to see more in the next couple weeks or months.
This is highly unorthodox.
It is highly unorthodox. I'm not sure whether it's smart or not. Among other things, I know nothing about Heather Sumner. So if she's a spectacular candidate, then he may have hit a home run.
Well, she's named after one town in the northeast, and she's from one town in the southeast, yeah. And he's from the far west of Connecticut. So geographically, that's good.
Not enough. Okay. But the you know, the thing about it, the under ticket, 2 points. One on the lieutenant governor. Yeah, you the reason people don't announce their picks till the end is that you sort of dangle it, and it's an important chip, and it's a way to make deals at a convention. And it sort of depends upon your theory of where all this stands and how important conventions are and how important even the entire party is. If you think you've got enough to primary and you really regard your campaign as going directly to the public in two stages, then if you've got a really strong running mate and that is going to increase your appeal to the people you're talking to, then I can see where you'd make that deal. If he finds himself caught having to actually deal with a convention – the great likelihood is it won't be a good thing. Secondly, if he goes anywhere past lieutenant governor, then he's insane. Okay, because now you've got like 100 people who want these other four jobs, and every morning it's bad enough. You know, maybe your own running mate, you're going to pitch the public and the party be damned, and you've got the right person. We'll see. After that, it's just nothing but heartache.
It does seem – and by the way, I think Tom Foley is making finally his announcement today in Waterbury that he's really going to run. At least I assume that's what he's going to tell us. But Kalilah, it sometimes when you do things like this – and this is not a precise analogy, mm-hmm. but one thing that I'm remembering is roughly 4 years ago when Governor Malloy pretty much thought he had won the election, but it was still in doubt. Things were still kind of simmering on the burner. The vote count wasn't precise. You know, we had that day or so, or I can't remember how many hours it was of uncertainty.
A year and a half.
Yeah. and he actually went to the state capitol and announced, I think, that it was going to be his
yeah.
chief of staff. And it didn't play well yeah. with people. I mean,
by the way, could we wait and get some official notification there? It's a bit unorthodox would be one way of saying it, but in many ways it's really bizarre, the timing of it all. So I understand that, you know, for this election, being able to garner enough campaign donations will be important and will set those candidates apart on the Republican ticket. And, you know, Boughton has already made some comments about Foley being independently wealthy and whether that means that he can be out of touch with the voters of Connecticut. And I guess 2 years he's had time to come to that realization. But it also means, as you said, how do you negotiate this? How do you barter this with the party? You need the party's strong support. And if people don't have an incentive to deliver votes to you, which is often what happens in the conventions and the time leading up to it, you know, does Boughton know something about the other possible contenders that we don't? Has he already just claimed that spot and is going accordingly? So I think we'll see a lot happen in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully someone within the party will take him aside and say, look, this is premature. If we have a shot, as Bill said, to really seize on the issues here, we have to do this in a smart way and take our time.
You know, Jennifer, one thing that Mark Boughton knows more about than any of us is what it's like to run for lieutenant governor, because he did it. He was the running mate for Tom Foley. This divorce is more acrimonious than many of Alec Baldwin's. They don't get along at all. And today, I know this morning, Tom Foley was on a different radio station, WPLR, kind of getting ready for this Waterbury appearance that he's making today. Did any clues come out of that?
Yeah, he definitely basically said he was going to run without actually – using the words. He was asked, how long is your speech going to be? They kept pressing him to find out whether or not he was going to run, just yelling at him, just do it, just say it. We all know you're running. And he refused to do it. But, he definitely hinted at it. And what he said is, my speech is going to be 10 minutes long. Would I give a 10-minute speech if I wasn't running? They pressed him on the fact that he's been touring and he's been going to different factories and he's been doing these different things. And they said, that definitely makes it seem like you're running. And he said, you're probably right. So Tom Foley definitely said he's running for governor without actually saying it ahead of 2 p.m. today.
Although I guess we kind of all knew that. But still. So another odd development, it kind of fits in with what we were talking about before with Boughton, is that within the last few weeks, two Republicans have come forward to suggest that they may be running for treasurer. One of them is Mr. Herbst from Trumbull, where he's the mayor or first selectman or whatever it is that Trumbull has. He won in this incredible landslide in his election, which really did suggest – I think his percentage was like around 70 or something. It suggested that a lot of Democrats and possibly even members of his opponent's family voted for him. He has a little bit of momentum there in Trumbull. And now this other guy, Mr. Ickes, has come forward. Ike is his name, not like Eisenhower though, E-I-C-H. And one of his claims to fame is that he's being described in reports as the producer of the Blair Witch Project. I did a little bit of research into this. It turns out that he's sort of a stockbroker who put $100,000 into the Blair Witch Project. He met with the five young filmmakers in a Hooters in Florida, gave them $100,000, and according to Forbes, stood to reap around $15 million for having done that. So he may not be a sort of a producer like Bob Evans or something like that, but he's more like a guy who really hit it big at the casino. But Bill, what's unusual about this, once again, usually for the Republicans to get people to run for some of these under-ticket spots, they line them up and make them count off by threes or something just to get anybody to come forward. It's unusual to have two people already interested in running for treasurer, especially against a treasurer who's been there for an incredible length of time and shows other than like a little odd encounter with the Hartford police once that didn't really seem to be her fault. I mean, she doesn't really have any blots on her escutcheon. Denise Napier, as far as I can tell, is a pretty popular treasurer.
I think she is. She's not as high visibility as some people. She hasn't done as much to seek personal visibility as most politicians, myself included, at the time who were in statewide office, do. Yeah, she's been a superb treasurer in the substance of the work. In many ways really outstanding. However, that's a fact that's almost invisible to the general public. But I don't think it's about Denise. I think that the attraction of these offices has to do with their sense of the overall moment in the state. This is the sixth year of a presidency, so the Democrats, the law of averages says things aren't looking good now. This is an economy that satisfies no one, and Connecticut's trails in many respects of what the country's doing. And so when you take all that and then you look at the political landscape, the party as a whole thinks that with the right candidate, it has a real chance here to score some victories. And again, it sort of goes that lieutenant governor, this is the under-ticket has always been something people run for, that you want to be comptroller, treasurer, AG, you get out there and you put a race together. The lieutenant governor gets picked. You're absolutely right that usually Republicans have to just, go out and Shanghai people and drug them and bring them to the convention and prop them up and hope that when they wake up they don't say no. And I don't think this is about Denise. I think this is about a general sense that this might be their year.
Well, another possible reason for this too is The Republican Party has run a lot of weak candidates in a lot of these sort of lesser races. And so getting somebody like Wayne Winsley to run against Rosa DeLauro, I mean, you really don't have a snowball's chance in hell. So why are you doing it? Well, I mean, people have all kinds of reasons for doing it. But one thing the Republican Party hasn't really taken advantage of, I don't think, is if you have a strong candidate in each one of these races, you know you're going to lose to Larson. You know you're going to lose to DeLauro. You know you're probably going to lose to Courtney. But running strong candidates and coordinating messages gives you a lot of free media time. And so if you want to make score points against President Obama in order to help your candidate in the fifth, running strong candidates all through the under-ticket races and the congressional races and then coordinating the message so every time you're on Face the State or a show like this one, you really can, particularly if you don't have a lot of money, which the Republicans don't.
Right.
It's a good thing to do, right?
And then it's the new face of American politics. How can you negotiate that media time, those multiple media platforms to get a message out? But what that requires is that you have a coherent message. Mm-hmm. And so the party has to have that conversation. What is the message? Being anti-Obama is not enough of a message. People want to know, what is it about that administration? What is it about the Democrats' approach that is not serving us well in the state of Connecticut? And it's very easy to point out particular policy areas where a message could come together. That requires coordination so that you're running those strong candidates who are forcing people to think about that message, but also have the opportunity for other political offices to have a shot. So I agree, it's not about Napier. It is about how can we make a run for power and for control. And that can be a valid motivation as long as there is a message, a platform, and a strategy.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here. We'll come back with more after this. This is Colin McEnroe. I want to mention today on our show, 1 o'clock, we last week went to Watkinson School and did a show about the healing power of music. This will segue nicely into what we're talking about right now. But we met with and worked with two musicians, Kate Callahan and Jim Chapdelain, both of whom had survived and recovered from catastrophic medical problems and who believed, not without some reason, that music had played an incredible role in it. We also talked to a therapist, a music therapist. There's been a burgeoning field of music therapy really since the 1990s. Somebody who actually works with everybody from patients suffering from dementia, people on the autism spectrum, to people with actual other kinds of organic or physical illnesses. And we also had a neuroscientist from Trinity. It was a really fascinating discussion, and it alternated with concert performances by the musicians. Kate Callahan brought her band with her. It was a lot of fun. So we've tried to edit that down. It was 2 hours long. We tried to get it down into a show today. That's the show you'll hear today. It really was an amazing evening, and I hope we can make that. I'm sure Kyone Wolf has figured out a way to make that sing on the air, too. And speaking of singing, we want to talk a little bit about Pete Seeger. So to sort of aid us in all that, Pete Seeger, as you probably know, died this week. To aid us with that, we have Bill Curry here, who actually had lunch, a two-hour lunch with Pete Seeger once. But we also have Rob Rosenthal, co-editor of the book Pete Seeger in His Own Words. He's also Wesleyan University's provost. So Rob Rosenthal, first of all, tell us why Pete Seeger seized your imagination as a scholar.
Well, I think he's really important as a model of a different way of thinking about music and entertainment and what it means to be an artist. He was never interested in being a star. He was not interested in a career. He was interested in being part of a movement. You know, he was someone who didn't want to sing to people. He wanted to sing with people. He wanted the audience to be a participant. He had this intense democratic approach to performance. And as someone who is interested in how political music works, I just found that fascinating.
Although through no fault of his own, and I this was pointed out in a Bloomberg News article that I read this week, through no fault of his own, he actually did become rather wealthy doing this. They were estimating his net worth near the time of his death at around $4.2 million, which would almost put Pete Seeger in the so-called 1%, which would be kind of ironic considering who he was. But first of all, I mean, I think that just sort of happened by accident, as you say. He was just a really, really popular singer. So Rob Rosenthal, I mean, and he was really sort of at least two guys, you know. One of them was a guy with a very, very powerful political message, and the other one was a guy who just really loved music. And as you're suggesting, was also very, very intent on getting other people to sing. Towards the end of his life, he said, you know, my voice isn't that great anymore, but I'm a really good song leader. I'll let you pick that up.
Yeah, and that was true from the beginning, really. You know, he always wanted to be helping other people to sing, to do anything. If you go back through his writings, you'll find he'll say, you know, people should spend almost no time watching television. They should be out skiing, or they should be out playing music, or whatever it is, but they should be doing instead of observing other people doing.
So, Bill Curry, you and Ralph Nader had a two-hour lunch with Pete Seeger. Tell us your memories of that. I mean, how did he come across?
This is a guy who, you know, had an extraordinary gentleness to him, and particularly his public persona. But you also saw some of it privately. I was thrilled to sit with these last, you know, these two lions of populism. what I saw in him was a certain steeliness that I hadn't quite expected from the sort of troubadour of children's songs. But it made me think about it, the life he led and the attitude of the government toward him, the actions that were taken against him for his performance before the House on American Activities Committee, things that happened to members of his family as a result, all the years in which he had to reconstruct his career in the way that we've described. It could have made a lesser man a bitter man. But on the one hand, while I saw a certain steeliness in him, there was just an absolute optimism about everything. When he appeared for Obama, he seemed thrilled appearing with Bruce Springsteen at a point in which the only functioning populist in American culture were musicians by that point. But he seemed to be very happy to be there for Obama, and his take on where the country was going at the time was, you know, he was thrilled. He thought it meant great good things for the future, and so he was, I thought at base, a really patriotic a guy in the deepest sense, and an optimist, as you know, in a way that many social critics might not be.
You know, Rob Rosenthal, do you feel as though that mindset changed very much over the course of a long life? I mean, was he the same guy in 1942 as he was in 2002?
Yeah, I think he was. I agree, Bill. He completely approached the world with this optimism. I don't think it was a naive optimism because he had been through really a lot. You know, he had been through things that were horrible for him and for his family, but he always retained this faith in people. He thought we could blow ourselves up, we could poison ourselves, but the actions of many small groups, small organizations, individuals, that is what's going to save us.
You know, Bill, I did love the things that he was saying. I was listening to him talk on Terry Gross. She had an archived interview with him. And he did say that whole thing about singing with people. And you were at the Watkinson event that we'll have today. One of the things I like to do at the end of an event is make the entire audience sing. And in fact, we had debated between Que Sera, which is what we made them sing, and Goodnight Irene. That was the other choice that we had. I now wish we had done Goodnight Irene.
But that was a wonderful event. Kate is a regional, should be a national treasure. I thought Jim was fabulous. And in the same way that Gandhi believed that if you showcased your own inner work and your character that it changed people chemically around you, Pete Seeger really did believe that singing did the exact same thing, that when you brought voices together, people were connected in a way that it formed a connection they would never entirely lose. And in fact, no, he wasn't. The magnificent Bruce Springsteen album, The Seeger Sessions, which is all, by the way, music that Seeger went out and collected from the bottom up,
all right,
and saved. Seeger wished there was more participation. He wasn't all that happy because it was too much performance and not enough participation.
All right, we've got to go because we want to end with a little bit of Pete Seeger singing "Turn, Turn, Turn." We want to thank Kalila Brown Dean from Quinnipiac, Jennifer Swift. Y'all come back now here from Connecticut Magazine and the New Haven Register. Bill Curry, our political analyst. Let's go out with Pete Seeger singing "Turn, Turn, Turn."
And a time to every purpose under heaven. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.